Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to your great lunch for your Qantas and Emirates flight to Dubai and then onwards to Sydney.
Hello, Kerry Phillips at Heathrow Airport for Rear Vision. I've just been through security, put my luggage through the X-ray machine and walked through the metal detecting archway along with everyone else.
General boarding will commence shortly. At this time, if you do have any passengers travelling with young children or infants and any passengers that require extra assistance, please do come forward for boarding now.
I'm about to board my flight back to Australia and the last thing I'm expecting is that we'll be hijacked. Unlike the passengers on Egypt Air Flight 181 on the 29th of March this year.
In breaking news, an Egypt Air passenger plane heading to Cairo has been hijacked and forced to land in Cyprus. Cyprus Broadcasting reports a hijacker's thought to be strapped with explosives and police have been asked to back away from the plane.
Egypt Air confirmed their Airbus 320 was hijacked and said there were 81 passengers on board. Initially, only women and children were allowed to leave, but Egypt Air says all the passengers, except for four foreigners, have now been released.
Many of us are all too familiar now with airport security. The queue, the list of prohibited items, the clear package with our toothpaste and shampoo, and the occasional random luggage search. And these days, we can be pretty sure we're not going to be hijacked on an international flight. But it wasn't always like this, as we'll discover in this, the story of safety in the skies. There were a handful of aircraft hijackings in the 1930s and 40s, but they increased after the end of the Second World War, reaching a peak during the 60s and 70s. Brendan Koerner is a contributing editor for Wired magazine and the author of The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking.
You really started to see it en masse after the Iron Curtain fell in Eastern Europe, and you had many individuals on the Soviet side of the Iron Curtain hijacking passenger planes from the East, taking them to, like, say, West Berlin or taking them to Denmark to achieve political asylum in the West to escape communism in the East. Then starting in the early 1960s in the United States, you had people hijacking planes and demanding to go to Cuba, which is shortly after the revolution, the island nation had been cut off from relations with the U.S. The only way you could get there was on a hijacked plane, really. So you had many individuals who kind of idealized life in Fidel Castro's Cuba at that time, who were hijacking planes, taking them there, and actually choosing to live in Cuba at that time. The number of hijackings escalated worldwide throughout the 1960s. It became a preferred tactic of many revolutionary groups. Here in the States, it was interesting because you had many people who would claim all sorts of political motivations for their hijackings to Cuba and then eventually going to other countries, trying to go to Italy, going to Argentina, trying to go to North Korea, North Vietnam. But oftentimes, you scratch beneath the surface of their political motivations, you would find personal grievances, personal difficulties, romantic prospects that had gone awry, professional difficulties, mental health problems. Eventually, in the early 70s, you saw a phenomenon in the United States where people were actually demanding large amounts of ransom in exchange for the hostages' lives, hundreds of thousands, eventually millions of dollars. So it really became more of an extortionate crime than a political crime.
Koerner's book tells the story of one of the most dramatic skyjackings in U.S. history.
So in June of 1972, a young couple, a man named Roger Holder and a woman named Kathy Kirko, who were boyfriend, girlfriend at the time, hijacked a Western Airlines jet that was departing Los Angeles bound for Seattle. Shortly before the plane landed in Seattle, Mr. Holder went to the cockpit and he was carrying a briefcase and he said there was a bomb in the briefcase and that he was taking over the plane and he wanted to go to San Francisco. And he wanted there to exchange the passengers for a black activist named Angela Davis, who was then on trial for her role in a murder plot that had taken place at a federal courthouse in California slightly earlier. Her case was actually going to the jury that day, and he wanted to liberate her and actually take her to North Vietnam. They went to San Francisco. Miss Davis wanted nothing to do with this young couple, refused to go. And so Mr. Holder, who was directing the hijacking, changed his mind and said he wanted a new plane that would take him and Miss Kirko to Algeria. And in fact, they got that new plane in exchange for the hostages, as well as $500,000 in cash. And they actually did go to Algiers with a stopover in New York. And once they got to Algiers, were granted political asylum there.
During the years that hijackings seemed commonplace, the airlines instructed their flight crews to go along with the hijackers' demands. Philip Baum is the editor of Aviation Security International and the author of Violence in the Skies, A History of Aircraft Hijacking and Bombing.
Generally, in the 1960s, at the time of the Cuban hijacks, the pilots were simply advised to go along with the hijackers' demands because the hijackers were never suicidal. They simply wanted to get to pastures they deemed greener. And generally, it was a little bit of fuel spend, a little bit of time wastage, but you reached your destination. There was some negotiation on the ground, and then all the hostages and the crew were able to return to where they came from. The Israelis took a different approach after the El Al hijacking in 1968. That was the first El Al hijack, and it was also the last successful El Al hijack, because they introduced two measures. One was the deployment of sky marshals on board aircraft, and there has been since that day a team of sky marshals on every El Al aircraft. And also the introduction of what is known as the passenger profiling system, or the risk analysis of passengers before they board aircraft.
Governments generally went along with what the airlines wanted.
Well, this is what I found so fascinating in my research. You know, at that time, first of all, the airlines, particularly in the United States, but all over the world, were really seen as the height of technology. Mass air travel was a very new phenomenon at this time. People lionized airlines, they lionized companies like Boeing that built the technology. They're kind of the Microsofts of their day in some ways. And so those airlines in particular had a lot of political power all over the world, both those in the West that were independent and those that were national carriers in other countries. And they actually did not want tighter security. They made a calculation that this could be a managed risk, that if you gave in to the hijackers' demands, did everything they said, took them where they wanted to go, gave them a few $100,000 if they wanted it, things would be okay. Your passengers would be safe. Your airplane would be intact. And oftentimes you would get the money back if there had been money given. There was political deals made to get ransom back from countries when people went abroad. Their fear was that if they put in lots of new security measures on the ground in particular, they would scare away passengers. Passengers would choose to drive or take trains instead, and it would wreck their industry.
While the early hijackers were often after refuge or ransom, militant groups, especially in the Middle East, realized that hijacking a plane was a way to seize the media spotlight. Dr. Simon Bennett is director of the Civil Safety and Security Unit at the University of Leicester.
Yes, in my opinion, one of the most spectacular watershed moments in the history of aviation terrorism was the hijacking by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine of three commercial airliners to a disused Royal Air Force airstrip in Jordan called Dawson's Field. And this was a highly organized, premeditated attack. The aircraft were taken, flown to Dawson's Field. The passengers were, over a period, released, leaving just the aircraft sitting in the desert sun. The PFLP, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, then invited the world's press with their cameras and with their tape recorders to Dawson's Field to witness those three beautiful aircraft belonging to various flag carriers being blown up.
How easy was it to hijack a plane back in those days?
I'd have to say very easy indeed. Security was there, but it was generally quite limited and low key, which explains why those first attacks in the 60s and 70s, and certainly the hijackings to Dawson's Field, were such a shock to the world aviation system, and also, you know, a call to arms.
Aviation standards and practices are set by a UN agency called the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO. Norman Shanks is professor in aviation security at Coventry University and a former manager of airport security at Heathrow Airport. He says that although the events at Dawson's Field shocked the world, change to airport security systems was slow.
Well, you would expect the change to be at lightning speed, or at least the speed of an aircraft flying from A to B. In aviation, things take years to change. What occurred after that was actually very small. There would have been some changes within the ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, their standards and recommended practices. But really, not much changed for you and I as a passenger until the mid-70s, about 76. And in the UK government decided that it was going to introduce passenger screening for all flights, not just high-risk flights. So that was our first change. We were probably ahead of the game with most countries in doing that, but it's just something that we started, say, in 1976. Prior to that, it had been an airline responsibility, but as it was going to apply to all passengers, it was decided in the UK that it should be an airport responsibility. So that would have been the first trigger change.
The end of 1972 in the United States, there had been a hijacking in November of that year where three men threatened to crash a plane into a nuclear reactor in the state of Tennessee. And that kind of symbolized a moment where the airlines couldn't really resist putting tighter security anymore, because the liabilities associated with causing some kind of nuclear holocaust in Tennessee would clearly put them out of business forever. So they actually bent to the public and political will at that time, and that was a start on January 5th, 1973 of universal physical screening. So all passengers at that moment forward had to walk through metal detectors and have their luggage searched prior to going on plane. So that was a real pivotal moment in the history of aviation security. An interesting part of that deal, though, was there was a real controversy over who would pay for that. The airlines wanted the creation of a government force that would have salaried public employees, and the government would foot the bill for those. Whereas the government wanted the airlines to have full-time employees, so make these security agents at the gate at the airports, airline employees with full benefits and full pay, and that would be very expensive for the airlines. A compromise was struck, which is kind of the worst of both worlds, which is that the government basically let the airlines farm out their security concerns to independent contractors. So third-party companies arose that were specialized in aviation security. The problem with that is that they would compete for contracts with airlines and airports, and they always favor the lowest bidder. And so you got progressively lower and lower pay and lower skills for aviation screeners. And that was actually a big problem that led to the horrible tragedy in 9/11, is this airport screeners making $12,000 a year, whose training consisted of 1 hour of watching a videotape of how to do their job. They're not qualified to do that job.
The introduction of the metal detecting arch and the X-raying of hand luggage contributed to the decline of hijacking into the 1980s. But radical groups found another way of bringing terror to the skies. An event over Scotland became another watershed moment in aviation security.
In what could be one of the world's worst air disasters, a Pan Am jumbo jet has crashed into a small village in southern Scotland. The plane, with up to 300 people on board, hit a petrol station, sending a fireball more than 100 metres into the air and spraying debris over houses in the village of Lockerbie.
258 people were on the plane, Pan Am 103, which left London Heathrow Airport, bound for JFK, New York City, at 1800 local time tonight. It was heading north before it turned out over the Atlantic.
The turning point for us in the UK was Lockerbie in 1988. According to the trial reports, it flew in from Frankfurt, originally starting in places like Malta, and then just moved through as a transfer bag, moving on to the final leg of the service, the Pan Am 103, from Heathrow to the US, where it blew up over Scotland. That was a big turning point for us, much, much bigger than 9/11.
What happened as a result of Lockerbie?
Well, I won't go into all of the details, but the key ones would be that we introduced a measure whereby all baggage going into the hold of an aircraft, checked baggage, would be screened. Up until then, it was only a small number of high-risk flights would have their checked baggage screened. The Americans, Pan Am in particular, were claiming to do this and actually putting a surcharge on passengers for the cost of screening passengers' checked baggage. And we know how successful that was, because they failed to find the bomb on Pan Am 103. But one of the measures that we introduced in the UK was the move towards 100% screening of all passengers' checked baggage. Other moves that we introduced within a year of the incident was the screening of all staff going to the airside security areas, screened to the same standard as passengers. This has subsequently become an ICAO standard as of 2014. You know, we introduced it in 1990, so 24 years later it becomes an international standard, and yet it's not carried out at every airport today, even though it is a standard.
You're listening to Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on RN. You can also hear us online, as a podcast, or through the free ABC Radio app. Today we're hearing about the ever-evolving struggle to keep us safe in the skies.
The Twin Towers of New York's landmark World Trade Center are now just a pile of rubble. The Pentagon is also a zone of chaos. And the body count, well, who can say, but it is many, many thousands.
Thousands of people started running away from the buildings as they were falling.
I never thought I would see something like this happen. I got there after the first plane hit and before the second, and unbelievable sight.
9/11 was a failure of imagination. That was what it was often described as. Failure to recognize the types of terrorist groups that are out there that are prepared to attack the values of our society. And people were horrified that people could learn how to pilot aircraft and fly them into population centers. I'm horrified that people could want to do that. But there was all the evidence was there beforehand that that was on the cards. I mean, we had an Air France aircraft that was hijacked a few years before that, where the authorities knew the intent of the hijackers was probably to fly that aircraft into the Eiffel Tower. We had a suicidal terrorist attack in Panama in 1994, Alice Chiricanos. A suicidal terrorist blew himself up on board the aircraft. If you're prepared to die for your cause, and if you want to create a terrorist spectacular event, and it was almost the logical progression. They'd wanted to bring down the World Trade Center beforehand. There had been bombing attempts there. But I think particularly in the United States, there has been a naivety that we don't have terrorists in our country. And yet, of course, they do.
Outrage and fear following the attacks on the United States on September the 11th, 2001, opened a new chapter in aviation security.
In the post-9/11 era, the United States created the Transportation Security Administration because they decided that they didn't really want contract screening companies actually providing the security at airports. And it's something that I'm quite sympathetic to. I'm very concerned when security is farmed out to often the cheapest bidder. However, if you're just going to put the same people that used to work for contract screening companies in federal uniforms and not really recruit the right caliber of staff, enable those people to think outside the box and to make intelligent decisions. And the only way you're going to do that is if you pay people considerably more. I struggle with the fact that around the world, we have government agencies that do immigration control, government agencies that do customs controls, quarantine. And yet often we decide that we don't need to do that when it comes to airport security. Or if we do, we do it the American style of sort of saying it's a government agency. And yes, it is, but not actually having people of the same caliber.
Probably the only measure that was introduced after 9/11 for the UK was the banning of metal cutlery on flights. For the rest of the world, 9/11 was a turning point. For America, it was a blistering change in the way that they actually approached the security issues at airports. Prior to 9/11, American aviation security was pretty low in standards. The irony, of course, is 9/11 was not a failure of the international regulations, because at that stage, domestic flights anywhere in the world were not covered by ICAO, only international flights. One of the changes after 9/11 is that domestic flights are now included within the same regime as all other international flights. But you could argue that 9/11 exploited a loophole, allowing passengers to carry the types of makeshift weapons that they had and get into the cockpits of the aircraft. Up until then, doors were typically not locked. It was quite common for flight crews to invite passengers up to the flight deck during travel. Getting access to the aircraft by the terrorists wasn't a difficult issue. It subsequently has become a much more difficult issue.
Over the last 15 years, further security breaches have illuminated areas of weakness in passenger screening. Incidents involving the so-called shoe bomber and the underpants bomber have meant additions to the prohibited list for carry-on luggage and made going through security a kind of semi-striptease. You might even get a pat down or a quick zap in the body scanner. Given all that, why did the crew on that Egypt Air flight in March believe the passenger when he said he had a bomb?
That probably comes down to their lack of confidence in the security measures at the airport they left. If the crew had a high confidence in the way in which they were screened as they went through the airport, as they should have been screened, and saying the chances of somebody being able to smuggle an explosive device on their person through that same process would be low, then they probably wouldn't have taken that action. So my takeaway from that particular incident was the crew themselves felt that the measures at the airport they had just left were not capable of giving them the confidence that a device couldn't be put on board.
After a tense six-hour standoff, all passengers and crew were set free at the Larnaca Airport in Cyprus. The hijacker gave himself up to authorities. It was revealed the supposed suicide vest he was wearing was fake. An Egyptian Foreign Ministry official claimed the man is not a terrorist, he's an idiot, while the president of Cyprus, Nikos Anastasiadis, also played down the seriousness of the incident.
It's not something which has to do with terrorism. You know what I mean?
Fortunately, the Egypt Air hijacking had a happy ending. Some of the passengers even took selfies with the hijacker. But does the incident show that even now we could do more to ensure the safety of the skies?
Feasibly, there is. In theory, there is. We could take security to an extreme level. We could, for example, hand search every single passenger. We could, for example, conduct a cavity search, which is not very comfortable, of every single passenger. However, in my opinion, if we did that, we would be playing into the hands of the terrorists, because one of the key objectives of Al-Qaeda, Daesh and similar organisations is to bring the Western economy to its knees and to cause great disquiet and discomfort to those of us who enjoy freedom and liberty. So it's very important to understand that in free societies like Australia, like the UK, like the USA, like Canada, it's very important to bear in mind that we need to preserve, as far as we reasonably can, our civil liberties. Because if we begin to erode those civil liberties, we are handing victory to Al-Qaeda and to Daesh and to similar nefarious organisations. That is exactly what they want us to do, and that is exactly why we are not going to do it.
First of all, fortunately, there are relatively few attacks against civil aviation, and the reality is that it is more dangerous for us to get into a car and drive to the airport than it is to get on board an aircraft. So I fly very frequently, and I very rarely worry about the security of my flight. I'm quite fatalistic about things like that. I think to a certain extent that often that there are different standards in different places and even within the same country is often good. I mean, the fact that we don't, I think security is often too predictable. I don't think we should really know when we go to an airport whether we're going to have to take our shoes off or not. I don't think we should know whether we're going to be screened using a millimeter wave system that can see beneath our clothing or a metal detector that can only detect whether we've got metal on our person. I think there are additional measures that we could put in place, the greater use of canine units to identify explosives, much broader use of behavioural analysis techniques, not only at the checkpoints, but at the entrances to terminal buildings, at the drop-off points for taxis and buses. And a lot of the airports where there's a perception that maybe there isn't that much security, well, that may just be a perception, because actually, I think really good security is when you can't see it. The checkpoint is a great deterrent, and it's been a very effective deterrent. It's probably the reason why the terrorists responsible for the Brussels Zaventem attack blew themselves up in the check-in hall. But we need to make sure that it isn't just security theatre. We need to make sure that what we're doing makes sense and that we do treat people differently because people do pose different threats. And I'm not arguing for racial profiling. I'm completely against racial profiling. But I do think we can be more intelligent about the way that we screen people.
So what would you like to see happen? How would what you're describing, how would that work?
We need to have, and we do have, international minimum standards for aviation security. I would like to see a much broader use of behavioural analysis techniques. And I think we need to get over all of the arguments against it. People are worried about people making subjective decisions based on race, religion, gender. And that boils down to appropriate training. And as I say, every other security agency, customs, immigration, the police, the military, everybody, every security agency differentiates, but we don't when it comes to airport security. And until we manage to convince the general public or convince the politicians that that is an essential part of an effective security regime, then we're just going to continue with security theatre. And I think that is the one big change that we need to make.
A lot of my colleagues, particularly those who had some experience in Israel, are very keen on profiling. Actually, it's the study of human behaviour. So you're looking at people acting out of place. These skills are used in a growing number of airports. America has a group of people called behaviour detection officers whose task is simply to look at passengers and other people in the security checkpoint area who might be worth investigating further. So they're looking for telltale signals, none of which I'm going to tell you, but they're looking for people that are acting out of place, nervously, perhaps displaying some other sort of characteristics which people are trained to look for. And those people could then be interviewed and put through perhaps a more intensive security screening process with either technology or a physical examination of themselves and the items they're carrying. So it's a mixture of behavioral technology and the better end of technology that would give us a greater chance of preventing terrorist activities.
Do you think that we're going to reach a point where the security screening and all that kind of thing becomes, I guess, a disincentive for people to fly?
I think we've probably been there, done that, got through it. If we think back to the Voiled Liquids attempt in the UK, you know, the government imposed such draconian measures where basically you couldn't take anything on board an aircraft. We had long queues of people very unhappy about not being able to take cabin baggage through. Everything had to go into the hold. So we had a period where people would stop flying. Personally, I never flew at that period because it was too much of a hassle. I'd find other ways to get to wherever I wanted to go. But you know, I think we learned a lesson from that, that the security measures, as they're enhanced, have to take into account the concerns of the traveling public, not only to make them safe, but to make them feel safe, but without it becoming too intrusive.
Norman Shanks, a former manager of airport security at Heathrow Airport. The other two aviation security consultants we heard were Dr. Simon Bennett from the University of Leicester and Philip Baum, the editor of Aviation Security International. Brendan Koerner is the author of The Skies Belong to Us, Love and Terror in the Golden Age of Hijacking. Judy Rapley is the sound engineer for Rear Vision. Bye from Keri Phillips.